And thanks to the organizers for inviting me. So I want to kind of give you guys the latest update on the work from the Frank Verstrata group in Vienna and also Ghent that I'm working on with some of the other PhD students. And I'll also cover a bit of previous work that some other PhD students have done who have left the group, including Burak, who's in this room. So the thing I'll talk about today is the latest incarnation where we also include the action of symmetries on topological orders in 2+1 dimensions. And we look at this using tensor networks. And I'll promise you that I'll get to some mention of how you can gauge these tensor networks and how you can do the reverse process of anion condensation that sort of undoes this gauging. So hopefully we get to that by the end, or I've failed my job. And I'll start with a bit of general background. Hopefully I can get through that in not too long. Also mentioning these recent constructions of symmetry-enriched topological order on the lattice with computing projector Hamiltonians. And then I'll get to tensor networks and mention what we've done. Cool. So let's start very generally. Everything I'll talk about in this talk is all based on the lattice. We're thinking of some system, probably scaling with the system size, but always keeping it at a finite number. And each local degree of freedom is some spin that's on a finite Hilbert space, so no underlying fermions or anything. And we're thinking about the full tensor, the Hilbert space, it's just a tensor product of the local Hilbert spaces. We have Hamiltonian terms that are acting on coupling local spins, and here everything's going to be local in two dimensions. We don't quite need it to be as strict as a square grid, but that's kind of a good picture to have in mind. And our full Hamiltonian is just a matrix given by the sum of these local terms, tensor product identity, everywhere else. So there's just a nice little picture of a Hamiltonian term acting on the spins. Okay. And the Hamiltonians I'm going to think about in this talk are also, we're going to assume they're gapped, because this kind of, it's a nice property that ensures us some stability, but without making everything too easy. The problem's still quite hard to sort of classify phases in the presence of this gap. So this energy gap should be there, and it should be uniform lower bound to the gap between some low-lying band that's kind of converging exponentially in system size, and then the rest of the excitations above that. And this should be sort of constant in system size. With this assumption, we can now start to gather these Hamiltonians into phases that we heard a bit about yesterday. So if two Hamiltonians are connected by some path that retains a locality property and also retains some uniform constant lower bound on the gap, then we say that they're in the same phase, and we basically want to work out pi naught of this structure, so which we want to work out the connected regions of this phase diagram of Hamiltonian space. And we're thinking about also enforcing symmetries, which refines this a little bit. So we want to only look at Hamiltonians that have some symmetry. And in this talk, I'll think about symmetries that are only tensor products of an on-site action. So this UG is some representation acting on a single factor, and then I tensor product that everywhere. And I want to demand that if I say a Hamiltonian symmetric, I mean like in terms of the local terms. So it's not sort of a fine-tuned thing. It's like if I perturb the local terms a little bit, I'll still have the symmetry of the Hamiltonian. And this sort of cuts down the number of paths we can take through our space and gives us, it means that all the sort of previous topological phases now break up into possibly a number of symmetry-enriched topological phases that are not connected by an adiabatic path if you preserve the symmetry. And these can have different sort of topological invariants of how the topological order interacts with the symmetry. So that's what we'll be thinking about later on. Okay, and I want to kind of give an example throughout the whole talk that keeps us going forward, which will be based, of course, on Toric code, because it's the best example. And here's my way of thinking about Toric code. We want to work in the x basis, and I'll just draw a little picture for the plus state as like an empty line, the minus state as a red filled line. And I should mention that the spins are on the edges in case anyone's not super familiar with this example already. But this might not be the right place for you if you're not. And the Hamiltonian's just this local sum of commuting projector terms, Z's enforcing the flux constraint around the plaquette, and X that's fluctuating the strings. And you can have a nice picture in your head for the ground state, which is just some like equal weight superposition of all strings. And let's assume we're on a sphere, so there's only one ground state. And then there's just a little picture of that for you. Okay. Now the anions in this model, sort of well known, we have the vacuum, and then we have three non-trivial types. Two are bosons, which braid mutually fermionically, and then there's an actual, well, there's an emergent fermion. And the fusion is just Z2 times Z2, so if we fuse the two bosons, we get the fermion. The F symbols are trivial, and there's an R symbol just enforcing this fermionic fusion rule, braiding rules. And you can sort of realize everything in the lattice in terms of the X and Z operators, but I'm not going to sort of do it that way because it's not going to be relevant for the rest of the talk. But it's all very concrete. Okay, and in this model, we also have a nice symmetry. So you can swap the two bosons without changing the topological order. And if we look at actually our concrete lattice Hamiltonian, we can implement this on the lattice directly. So here's the symmetry action. It just does a Hadamard on every site, which swaps X to Z. And then we also have this little tricky bit where we have to shift the lattice to the dual lattice. And actually what I'll talk about later is this sort of new construction by a few groups of a string net model enriched by symmetry where you can actually realize all symmetries without ever having to do something like this. Sort of all symmetries modulo a little bit of hand waving that they have to be anomaly free in some sense, which I can maybe say a bit about later. So in particular, I'll show you a realization of this same topological order where this symmetry is realized without having to shift the lattice at all. Okay. Now, if we have a local symmetry, like the previous one, but maybe a bit nicer, like without the shift, that we can really implement in a patch, we can create a domain wall of this thing. So if we just imagine applying the symmetry instead of everywhere, if we applied it everywhere, we'd be left with the same ground state. So now this blue thing is just meant to be like my ground state. If I apply the symmetry within some region, I'm left with basically the same ground state everywhere away from the edge, because this is kind of a symmetry if I see it everywhere. But then at the edge where I applied it there and not there, I'm left with this domain wall. And you can actually make this the ground state of some modified Hamiltonian, where you basically just twist only the Hamiltonian terms crossing this domain wall. And you can ask what happens if I take one of these domain walls and I let it sort of end. So because it's a domain wall between the topological order and itself, I'm allowed to make a monogamy defect of this thing. And I can look for the topological superselection sectors at the end there. So if I looked for the superselection sectors of a trivial domain wall, I'd just recover the emergent anions. But now I can ask the same question, but at the end of such a domain wall. I have some references for where this sort of was first thought about in the QI context, at least. And there's a nice paper, for me at least, that sort of has a really concrete way of writing all the data for these things, which I'll present, but I think the idea probably goes back to Tureyev or something, the actual construction. But I'll present it according to this paper from Station Q. So we can collect all of this emergent data of the symmetry-enriched topological order into this structure called like a unitary G-cross braided fusion category, actually with a few extra constraints like that are basically modularity, but for the symmetry-enriched topological order. The way the fusion works is pretty much the same as for a normal fusion category. We just have an extra constraint that we have this G grading of the simple objects. And the fusion has to respect this G grading. We have F symbols which work the same except they have to respect the G grading. But braiding can be quite different. So now each of these diagrams, if usually you think of them as basically a world line of some point, like excitations, these world lines now carry some sheet. And the convention for this diagrammatic calculus is the sheet goes backwards into the board. So imagine each line is carrying a sheet behind it. It's like the world sheet of a domain wall line. And when these things cross, the one that goes under can be acted on by the sheet of the one going over. So you see this braiding is a bit looser because when this A-type charge goes under this B-type charge, it can be acted on by H. And the hat here is just inverse, in case that's confusing. And you can reduce this into the fusion basis like you usually do. Then there's actually a few more extra pieces of data you also have to worry about, because there's now sort of symmetry actions going on whenever I move these sheets around. So if I have like a fusion vertex, I can have some non-trivial action of the symmetry of element K here on that vertex when I pull the domain wall across this vertex. And when I have a splitting vertex of two sheets from another one, I can have some projective phase coming from the difference in acting with CG on this anion compared to G and then H. Sorry, G and H compared to G and then H. C is the charge over there. Okay, so there's these other extra pieces of data. And very similarly to normal braided fusion categories, these things have to satisfy some consistency equations to describe sort of a non-ill construction. And the first one is just the same as the pentagon equation, except there's a grading going along for the ride. The second one is a looser version of the hexagon equations, where you have this extra piece of data. So in one of the in like the left-handed one, say, there's this extra eta piece of projective action data, and in the other-handed one, there's sort of the U somewhere there. And this means that this is sort of more general than just a normal braided fusion category. And you can find sort of these G cross braidings for some fusion categories that don't admit normal braidings. But this contains a normal braided fusion category, kind of obviously, if you just get rid of the G grading. Okay. So that's, that's sort of the overarching sort of algebraic description of these things. And we'll come back to that later, how you sort of derive that from the lattice. But let's get back to our example for now. We want to think of this G-graded toric code, well, Z2 graded by the EM swap symmetry. And what happens if you put these defects in, which you can actually do directly on the lattice, even with this lattice shifting, but it's a bit complicated. And we'll do it in an easier way later because we don't have this lattice shifting. But let's just look at the algebraic description. The simple objects are just the trivial sectors, just the anions of the toric code, as it has to be. And then the non-trivial sector has these two defect types. And their quantum dimensions will be root 2, so the total quantum dimension squared of this sector has to match this sector. And then here's just the fusion rules. If you kind of throw an E or an M onto one of these guys, you flip it. If you throw an EM on, I think it absorbs that. And if you look at this one, it should be kind of reminiscent. So if you think about just take one of these defects, like the sigma plus one, and fuse it with itself, it fuses to the vacuum plus a fermion. So that sort of reminds you of Ising theory. And people notice this. And so there was some question early on about the relation to double Ising. And I guess we kind of know what it is. It's precisely that. So I don't know if I should cover double Ising. Double Ising is just two copies of Ising, one time reversed. So I use these hats to denote time reversal. And I haven't written down the F and R symbols because I think they were given earlier and they're not really necessary to understand. But here's sort of the fusion rules for one half of the theory, and the other half is just the same, but sort of decoupled copy with reverse braiding. And the precise relation between these things is that if you gauge the Z2 symmetry, the EM swap symmetry, which there is a recipe for purely in sort of categorical terms, but we'll do in a different way, and you can also do directly onto lattice, then if you gauge the symmetry on the toric code with this EM swap symmetry, you get double Ising. And if conversely, you condense this certain Z2 sub-theory of double Ising, where it's just generated by a single boson, then you get back to toric code. And when you sort of condense, you also get defects. And the defects you get by doing this condensation will be precisely these sigma defects in the toric code. And on this side, there's just this relation between the toric code with twist to the normal toric code. So yeah, toric code, I guess, would have another SET order, and there's some choice in how to add defects to toric code. This is sort of, well, one of the only interesting ways to do it, up to changing the choice of braiding. So if you sort of add these defects, you get to the toric code with twists, and if you throw them away, you get back to the toric code. That's kind of obvious. The interesting parts are over here. Okay.
So I have a quick question.
Sure.
So when you say gauge Z2, mm-hmm. You mean equivariantize Z2?
I think it's the same thing as equivariantizing. I'm only a little bit confused because, well, maybe we should take that offline. Let's say it's the same.
Yeah,
Thanks. And this is part of a more general story. It's also sort of nicely covered in the Station Q paper where you can have sort of, let's say this is a braided fusion category. Then you can add defects to this, and there's some sort of possible obstructions. If these things disappear, you get a nice consistent unitary G-crossed braided fusion category of the topological order with the defects. And then there's this sort of gauging process, which is, I think, the same as equivariantizing the group action there, that will take you to this another braided fusion category over here. And I think if this is a modular tensor category, this one will also be a modular tensor category. And this one in the middle will be the G-crossed version of modular. Okay, and then there's a nice inverse process, which is a sort of particular type of very simple anion condensation where the sub-theory is closed and consists of bosons. Okay, I'll kind of explain this from a tensor network perspective for the rest of, well, not for the rest of the talk, once we get past the construction on the lattice. Okay, so we're at the right place. So hopefully we're kind of familiar with the StringNet models by now. We saw a few talks about this already. But let me just recover it again. It's pretty much a straightforward generalization of the toric code with a lot of extra difficulties. So the degrees of freedom basically live on the edges if we assume there's no multiplicity. And they're just these string types, which are simple objects from some category. For example, you can take vec of Z2 to get toric code, or you can take the fusion category of Ising to get double Ising as the emergent topological order. And then the Hamiltonian is basically given by just some constraint on the vertices that checks the fusion rules, and then some fluctuation term, which is morally the same as the fluctuation term in Toric code, but is quite a lot more complicated to write down. But you can think of it as just taking a sum over all the simples and then fusing in a loop of that simple type on each plicket. Okay, and then you can think of the ground state of this thing, again, pretty similarly to the Toric code. It's like an equal weight superposition of all allowed fusion configurations with some certain weights given by the category data. Okay, and what this achieves, okay, so here's the thing we just described in the previous slide, and I always assume these are unitary fusion categories because we kind of want to get Hermitian Hamiltonians because we're thinking about quantum phases. And then if you go and take this and find the superselection sectors, what you find is this modular tensor category, which is the double of the input category. So this is just a roundabout way of achieving like this construction of the Drinfeld center of this category. And there's sort of very concrete ways of doing this. And the one I like the best is Ocneanu's tube algebra. And that's what we'll generalize later to the defects. So I'll also describe as a special case of that how you actually do this sort of in a very concrete way. Also with tensor networks, because that's the way I like to think, but you don't really need to use tensor networks to do that bit of the construction. So the recent sort of update on this to the SET, to the SET side of things, is a modified StringNet construction where you also introduce, so you take a graded fusion category as input. There doesn't have to be any sort of braiding or anything, just graded fusion category. For example, this Ising fusion rules, but with this Z2 grading taken into account. So I didn't like mention it explicitly, but if you looked at the fusion rules for Ising before, you saw that if you multiply sigma with itself, you get 1 plus psi, and if you multiply either 1 or psi onto sigma, you get back sigma. And if you multiply these guys, they remain amongst themselves. So this has a Z2 grading in the fusion, as indicated there, with that being the non-trivial element. Then the way you modify the lattice model is by also including this group that's doing the grading, and you include these variables on the faces. You now have graded labels, graded string labels on your edges, but besides the grading, they're basically the same. The fusion constraint works the same. It's just a fusion constraint at the vertices. The fluctuation constraint works very similarly. It's still just multiplying in a simple object, a string of a simple object into the lattice and fusing it in. But now when you multiply in something from, so here, let's say H is sitting on this face here, and I fuse in this string type, which is in sector G, then I have to left multiply H by the group element G. And the other part that you have to include as well is this sort of constraint that the sector of a string type on an edge has to match the difference of the group elements on the faces next to it. So what this achieves is basically changing the ground state so that now you tie all strings of, say, sector of a non-trivial sector to a boundary of some sort of domain. So instead of these strings freely fluctuating, they're now tied to be domain walls, which changes the topological properties because it means they can't sort of wrap a torus, for example. They can't be homologically non-trivial. And what this thing achieves is actually quite similar to, it's sort of a modified version of this, of what the StringNet achieves. So we have this different kind of double, which I'll describe more concretely later. So hopefully it's not too confusing now. But yeah, this is what I showed in the previous slide. And now if you look at these defect superselection sectors at the end of a domain wall, so I can easily create a domain wall of any group element in that model. Oh, so something important I probably didn't explicitly say. Let's go back to this model. This Hamiltonian has on-site left multiplication by G symmetry. So if I just multiply every plicket left multiplied by G, that's a symmetry of the Hamiltonian. So, and in this way, you kind of realize a string net with built-in symmetry of any group you like. And the way this relates to the emergent symmetry, I'll cover later. Okay, so we have this Hamiltonian with this symmetry. We can look for the defects of that symmetry. And what we find is some G cross braided fusion category with the double of the sort of trivial sector, the sector of the identity element, as the topological order, and then some kind of SET going on top of that, which can be non-trivial. In particular, we can we'll see that we can construct the Torah code with twists this way. And this is sort of related. It's sandwiched between two, how would you say, like just normal string net models. So if I take this graded fusion category, I'm just forget the grading, I have a fusion category, right? I can take the string net of that and then look for its super selection sectors, and I'll just find the double of that graded fusion category, but without the grading considered. And the way this is related to this guy is via this gauging G and condensing this rep G. And you can also do this directly on the lattice, but I think I'm, well, I could probably describe that a little bit, yeah. So in the there's actually like a sort of a framework to do this on the lattice, which is pretty easy. You just introduce some G bosons and then fluctuate the, and introduce a flatness condition, and then sort of fluctuate the these gauge configurations. But you can actually implement it directly on this fixed point model really simply, I think, just by projecting basically all the group variables onto the plus state. And what this effectively does is just unpins these strings in non-trivial sectors from domain walls, which returns you back to the normal string net, because now a string in a non-trivial sector can wrap a torus, for example, again. And to go this way, you're just doing what I sort of said before. You're just pinning everything that's in a non-trivial, every string that's in a non-trivial sector to the domain wall of something. And then there's this other string net model that you're also related to, which would just, if you took the string net construction of like a trivial sector directly and just forgot about the other sectors, you just realize a normal string net. You could take the super selection sectors of that to get its double. And the relation between these two doubles is less interesting. It's just sort of introducing the defects and, yeah, throwing them away. So hopefully that's reasonably clear. And so now I'm finally getting to the part that we've sort of done. That was all covering recent developments. And what we're looking at is basically instead of just the tube algebra to construct this center given the input category, we want to find some way of constructing the immersion SET given this G-graded category. And we do it in tensor networks. So I should explain what tensor networks are briefly. Okay, so this is a tensor. The way we think about tensors is very down, like I'm very sort of concrete and pedestrian. There's no structure, so think minimal structure. It's always over C. And really, we think of this as some array of numbers that is going to be in a computer, because often it is. So here, and the notation we use is basically this Penrose notation. So here, this box is like an array with three indices that run over some finite index set. And if I fix each of these indices, say alpha, I, and beta, I'll get just a complex number. Okay, not too complicated, hopefully. And we use this Penrose notation for summation. If I have two of these boxes and I join an index, then there's an implicit summation, so beta doesn't appear in this picture, but I'm summing over the beta index of A and B, and I've fixed the other ones on the outside there. So hopefully that makes sense to people. And probably the most, definitely the most successful of these tensor networks, which is probably why people have been studying them so much, is this variational class of matrix product states. So a matrix product state is just, it's a very good ansatz for 1D spin chains. And you can think of it another way as just an ansatz where I assume that the coefficients of any basis state, so pick some basis of each local tensor factor, and the coefficient of any basis state is just given by a product of matrices. And what this means is now that a lot of things that would be intractable before become tractable, like you can compute correlation functions and stuff, because instead of having some huge index tensor that's just a arbitrary coefficient, you have a product of matrices, which your computer can do quite efficiently, especially if you have MATLAB. Yeah. So the picture for this is this diagram. And so the implicit summation is over these indices, and they should just be continued. And then there's this one periodic boundary condition index, which is why there's a trace there. OK. I won't say too much more about MPS, but you should go and look up a review about MPS if you're interested in spin chains. Gap spin chains. And the generalization to 2D that's going to be mostly relevant now is this thing called projected entangled pair states. So the tensor network doesn't have to have the same structure as the lattice, but projected entangled pair states is the class of tensor networks where we basically put a tensor on every lattice site. And this class seems pretty good at capturing gapped ground states of local Hamiltonians on the same lattice. So the way this is formulated is I take, so say I have a square lattice, I take a 5-index tensor here, and then I just contract it as so. And then imagine if this is a torus, I'd be closing these boundary conditions periodically again, and that will give me a state. Okay. So back to our example. For toric code, here the degrees of freedom are on edges, remember. So I want to start by just rotating 45 degrees for convenience. I then block in this way, so four sites around each vertex are blocked onto that vertex, and you'll see this covers all sites. Look for a second. And the local tensor is just given by this guy. So there's the four spins on each site. They have some Z2 values, and this addition's mod Z2. And you can check that this will just give you back the equal weight superposition of all. So I haven't normalized the state here, but it will give you back an equal weight superposition of all closed loops. The actual exact way this works is not so important here. The important part is that this guy, has symmetry. So if we think about what this local piece gives us access to, it's like a local piece of a state, but it knows something about the correlations because of these virtual indices. So we can ask, what's the maximal thing we can see if we try to invert this tensor? So imagine we could just invert the tensor. We could see everything that the virtual indices see. So these virtual indices have access to some correlation degrees of freedom. And if we try and invert them from the physical index, and imagine that this was in left invertible. So this is just the identity drawn from this index to this index. Sorry, the notation might be kind of confusing. This line is meant to be this one here. Okay, so if it was invertible, we could recover everything. But it in fact turns out that this class of tensor networks that satisfy this, even though this is the generic case, once you kind of coarse grain enough for an arbitrarily chosen A, these can't have topological order. So they can't have a ground state degeneracy and so on. So that's bad. What we've kind of been looking at recently is generalizing this to different kinds of pseudo-invertible tensors. And the thing we've kind of settled on is having a matrix product operator here. So this matrix product operator, I gave a slide for, is basically the same as the matrix product state, except it's now each site is mapping from some basis to another basis on that spin. So it's just the MPS version for a state. So if you just folded, say, this output leg into the input leg to get a tensor product of the input and output as your local spin, it would just be a matrix product state. And the good thing about these guys is that we can use all the theory of matrix product states on them. So that's how we've kind of learned everything we know about matrix product operators. And yeah, to get anywhere, so that's the first step. We say, so suppose let's conjecture this, not conjecture, but sort of hypothesize this for a class of tensor network states. They have this sort of injectivity structure. To get anywhere for topological things, we also need this to be kind of a robust property. We don't want it to matter if we have 3 sites or 10 sites. And a way to ensure this is to also propose that this should be a symmetry of a local tensor. So if we have the same matrix product operator, we want to be able to move it through the lattice, basically. So this is purely, these indices are purely virtual. You'll never see them physically. They just take correlations between 2 different points. And on these indices, we should have this symmetry, which is like this string operator. But it's not a physical string operator, I should say. Okay, so this is the class of tensor network states we look at for topological order. And in the toric code, we indeed have this. So if you look at applying Z, so just like -1 if the Z2 variable is 1 and nothing if it's 0, then you see if you apply Z to these 2 indices, it's equal to applying Z to these 2 indices. So here, Z is your matrix product operator symmetry. It's like a very simple matrix product operator because it's just a tensor product operator. Okay, a more non-trivial example is the string nets. So here, I probably need to explain my notation for the string nets a bit. For convenience, I've copied each edge degree of freedom onto 2 adjacent sites, but don't be too distracted by that, it doesn't really matter. So each edge degree of freedom is copied onto the adjacent sites, and I've gone to the dual lattice, so what was a trivalent site before is now this triangle. It has three spins on the physical level because I've copied the edge adjacent to it onto that site. And then these three indices here and so on are virtual indices. And this sort of connection I draw this in this way just means there's a delta condition. Then besides this delta condition, the weight of this tensor is just given by an F symbol up to some quantum dimension normalizations, which I'm just brushing over because they're kind of tricky. And actually, the way you can think of this is just basically if you take a surface and triangulate it, and then take the cone over the surface, you have like, well, let's assume it's a sphere, a triangulated sphere, and I take the cone over that, I have some ball, I put trivira on the ball, that's the tensor you get. So hopefully that makes sense. And then a matrix product operator you get is pretty much the same, pretty much similarly inspired if you think about taking the tetrahedron of a trivira weight and just like flattening it in a different way. These are the four sides of the tetrahedron. And it looks like a square. Okay. And it's again just given by some delta conditions that are drawn as connected lines and then some F symbol. And because of the sort of pentagon equation or Pachter moves that these trivira tensors satisfy, you have this, what we call the pulling through equation of these virtual symmetry operators for your string net state. So here, yeah, that's just written very lazily, the pentagon equation. And here's what it means in terms of these tensors. You can take this matrix product operator and you can move it through on the virtual level. So this is still not a physical string operator. It's like purely a virtual symmetry of kind of the correlation degrees of freedom. And another important point is, see this this red F index here. Maybe I should show the previous slide. If you have like a long matrix product operator that's much longer than this, you have the same F index touching all of them. So they're all kind of in, they're all this one, you can kind of break up these MPOs according to this F index. So for each index of each a simple object in the category, I have a different F index. And these, each, you know, if I fix this to be one, say, I'll get an MPO for one. If I fix this to be psi, I'll get an MPO for psi. If I fix this to be sigma, I'll get an MPO for sigma. And these MPOs together form a representation of the, like the fusion algebra of the category you put into the string net. Hopefully that makes sense. Okay, so kind of the summary of this, which I have to go over pretty quickly because we want to get to symmetry and rich topological order. But for topological order, we have these matrix product operator symmetries, and these things form a fusion category. So if you have the closed matrix product operator, it's going to give you a representation of the fusion rules. If you have like this open matrix product tensor, then this is like an object. These maps on the virtual level are like morphisms. And if you multiply two of these guys inside of the physical direction, then it's like taking a tensor product of this virtual direction. And you can actually find like a fusion morphism between A and B and some C that's in the fusion product, which I didn't explicitly draw. And so, yeah, this kind of is another way of thinking about Levin-Wen as realizing the Hilbert space of pictures modulo local relations. I think I said that a bit earlier, like the ground state you can think of as all admissible pictures. So here what we have is, I'm just drawing the tensor network state for a Levin-Wen ground state, but now the tensors are kind of small. And I can put into the virtual level some MPO symmetry, and this is equal as a vector. Now I can just think of abstracting this to some kind of background, like that's the vacuum. And then this equality is just implementing this local relation. So I could create, so here I'm imagining the quantum dimension of this particle to be one, so I think I called it psi. Then what this equality in tensor network land is doing is just this local relation of pictures. Okay, and one sort of side effect of that is that if you want to close this on a torus, so here I'm thinking of closing this tensor network state on a torus, and this B is like some arbitrary tensor. So I could put an arbitrary boundary condition along the closing edge and kind of contract that with the tensor network. But you can actually show that this can always be written as a sum of these kind of tensor networks just with the minimal sort of spanning MPOs on of the skeleton of the torus. So here X and Y are just some MPOs. And I don't know why I didn't draw them in red, sorry. But if you kind of went back to the tensor world, this would be, you know, the tensor network for the ground state, and this would just be an MPO on the virtual level. So we have like a characterization of how their ground spaces look, and it's the right thing for the trivira, for the Levin-Wen model. Okay. And one thing I just want to say before I move on to the global symmetry part, all this works for the fixed point models. But the reason why we kind of developed this is because we want to look at these things numerically. And everything we've developed works for a large class that are not for fixed point Hamiltonians. So we can sort of start with this sum tensor with one of these symmetries, and we can look at deforming it and doing all sorts of things, even going through phase transitions. And it'll still sort of retain the same symmetry algebra. Although on the physical level, these string operators will be totally smeared out and impossible to work with. The nice thing about this kind of class of tensor networks is that the symmetry operator on the operators on the virtual level stay the same. Okay. Now, when we add a global symmetry, the game kind of goes similarly, except now we also need to think about what happens when I apply this symmetry. So basically what we want to do is, with some matrix product operators, capture the domain walls. So if I apply the local representation of G everywhere within a region, I want to be able to capture that with some matrix product operator on the edge. And again, I have a similar condition that's like this should be able to move through the lattice, but now only up to a local action. So if G is trivial, this is the same as the rules I showed you earlier, if it's a trivial element. Yeah. And to capture the graded string net with the G graded string net, the construction I showed earlier, with a tensor network, really requires almost no effort. So again, I'm kind of doing things in a slightly weird way. The face variable that would be touching this trivalent vertex is copied onto the trivalent vertex. So the face variable will appear many times, but just copied. But now I just need to introduce one other tensor, which just copies the sector information of the string passing through it. So if I have this label in sector G, this spin here will just pick up G. It will just copy G to the physical level. So now I have access to this, whereas before these virtual indices wouldn't be visible from the physical level. And now this obeys a similar pulling through equation, but with the group action. So these are the same tensors, the same MPO tensors. I just now have a grading on this leg. And if this is in the G sector, then to pull this through, I need to also left multiply by G here. And this equation kind of shows that the tensor network, the ground state that this tensor network is giving, has the symmetry, at least on a sphere. On a torus, like there can be some action on within the ground space. But okay, let's leave that for now. And so for our example, what this does is just break up these MPOs into sectors. So if we have the sigma, that'll be in the non-trivial sector. And we get this graded fusion algebra instead of just an ungraded fusion algebra. OK, and so we have a similar story to the topological case, except now our MPO algebra has a grading, but everything else basically works the same. And the abstraction to diagrams works very similarly, except now we have to introduce one other piece of notation, which is this dark shaded region. And this just means applying the local symmetry action within that region. So you'll have these equations for a defect of, for an MPO of type A in a G sector that's equal to applying the local action within that region. And you can sort of work things out this way. OK, so finally we get to the thing I promised, which is how to find the defects in this, in these tensor networks. So the ansatz we would start with is basically we have a domain wall, which is modeled by our MPO. And we want to end this in some way. And of course, there's like many choices we could choose at the end there. But what we really want to do is break these up into definite super selection sectors. And the way to see how to do this is, imagine this is on like a sphere. So technically, we'll need another defect at the other end of this domain wall, but kind of just push that to the side for a minute. And imagine you're on the sphere. You can create a loop, a small loop of an MPO in the one sector, which is a true like topological symmetry purely on the virtual level. And you can drag that through the whole lattice and kind of surround this defect at the end there. This gives you like an action of the one sector on this tensor here. And you use this action to basically block diagonalize the possible choices there into super selection sectors. OK, so we can write this. So here, this green tensor is just some tensor, some four-index tensor I can put between these MPOs, where this is in sector G and this MPO is in sector 1. So there's some virtual indices coming in, and I can just put any tensor I like there. But I know because of the connection with graded fusion categories that I can kind of resolve this into fusion vertices where, OK, okay, these guys are in the one sector and they fuse with these guys in the G sector at these two fusion vertices. So the sum is over this type of vertex. We can kind of upper bound the size of the algebra that way. And you see that actually, we can see that it's actually a star algebra. So if you just take Hermitian conjugation of this, so this is just an operator mapping from the outside indices to the inside indices. And if you just Hermitian conjugate that, you find that you remain within the algebra, but you get some other element. And we can write formulas for all these things, but they're kind of messy, so I don't do that here. And if we multiply two, we can reduce it back down to the same algebra. So it's a star algebra that I'm calling the defect tube algebra. Actually, there are G of them because we have this G label here and they don't mix. So if I had like one of them in, say, sector H and one in sector G and I multiplied them, I would just get zero. So we get like G different decoupled algebras, which I'm calling like the defect tube algebra, slight generalization of the usual tube algebra, which is contained as the sector where G is equal to one, or like more catchily, the Dube algebra. So let's work out some. So now each of these Dube algebras, we want to break into superselection sectors. And we do this by looking for the irreducible central idempotents. These will just project onto the blocks of this C star algebra, this finite C star algebra. And I've just written the conditions for the central and idempotent on this tensor. So if it's a irreducible central idempotent, my like picture notation is it has a little white dot for the rest of the talk. So these are just two of the conditions it satisfies, and you can't write it as a sum of non-trivial, as a non-trivial sum of other ones. Okay, and these guys give you your superselection sectors. So to summarize like that bit of the talk, yeah, the input thing or the symmetry we found of the tensor networks with symmetries, with physical symmetries, were G-graded fusion categories, and the like excitation, the sort of superselection sectors we construct from that give us the defects of this SET, but we still want to work out the physical properties of this SET. So in principle, once we have these things, actually we know everything. It's just a matter of extracting it. And here, by this I mean G cross modular tensor category. Here I think I'll just talk about extracting the projective action of the symmetry on the anions, which you can also use to find the permutation of the anions by the symmetry, and then I think I'll mention the SNT matrices, but you can actually reconstruct the full G cross braided fusion category from this. Okay, so the way to find the action of the symmetry on the anions is to construct these kind of domain wall operators. So you might have occurred to you, like, what did we do with the action of these domain walls where this was not one? And each anion, so this was projected into a specific block, the way you find the action of, say, H on G is by projecting, sorry, not G, H on a certain anion in sector G, or certain defect in sector G, is by just projecting an arbitrary tensor there in the sort of sector where G and H meet onto this guy. So this is like, this choice is just purely arbitrary. If you make a really bad choice, you could get zero with this diagram, but if you make a generic choice, you won't get zero. So you take this set of all sort of domain walls that where H meets G and just project it onto this idempotent you found. That gives you a representation of the domain wall up to some factor. You can normalize this factor by requiring unitarity. So I didn't kind of mention, but all of this is for unitary reps, although you can start to generalize that. But we're sticking to the case of unitary reps. Okay, so that's how you find the domain walls. And if you just take the domain wall you found, so here I use the same notation for this dot, but here the G and the H tell you that it's H acting on that sector. So if this H was one, we would just recover the idempotent itself, or the representation of that defect. And if you just conjugate by this domain wall you've found, then you'll find the permutation action on the anion. I'll show an example of that later. Okay. So from this, we can find the G cross S matrix, which more or less you get by just taking one of these things you've calculated. This is a four-index tensor. You just turn it 90 degrees, and you can basically flip the arrow up to conjugating the group element, up to inverting the group element. I don't want to go too much into that. It's a little bit more complicated, but this will give you the eight matrix elements of the S matrix. The T matrix is also pretty easy. You just take your representation of the superselection sector and you twist it by 360 degrees and then reduce it back to the original basis. Although now, because the sector might be non-trivial, you might have an action of that on this domain wall. So this thing is not Gaussian invariant in general for symmetry-enriched topological orders, because here we have the domain wall GH for this anion, or this defect, sorry. But here we have the domain wall H for this defect. So there's some kind of gauge choice you could make that kind of would change actually what this answer is. But this in particular contains the subset of topological spins for the underlying anions of this topological order that we built the SET on top of. And those are gauge invariant. So between this G crossed S and T matrices, there is some gauge invariant data which you can recover. Another way of getting gauge invariant data from it is to gauge the full theory and then, okay, which I'm going to talk about now, and then look at the S and T matrices of the gauge theory, which is again just a topological order, so S and T are invariants that are not sensitive to the choices of gauge. Okay, so let's go back to our really complicated diagram with the relation between these different string nets, and we're going to look at this little piece now. So how this SET we calculated is related to the double of the category, but forgetting the group grading. So I want to take a step back and just say this step, if you have used the tube algebra at all, it should be pretty clear, but if you haven't, it's probably not very clear. But this, for SPTs, all you have for each domain wall is a single, this is an invertible topological order. There's no different superselection sectors. For each domain wall, you just have a single sort of defect, which I'll call G. And then for that defect, G, you can have the action of the group on that guy. So that's these B guys, they're just the domain walls. This is just a projective irrep. So the action of H on G can be projective. This thing's a projective irrep. And the way you find the superselection sectors of after you gauging this is just by, so these are the superselection sectors of the twisted double, is just by taking this projector onto the irrep, that gives you some projector, and then you take the sum over the congruency classes. So the moral of the story is basically this works exactly the same for more general categories. We already kind of know this bit. This is from the thing I just showed you. We have these domain wall actions on the defects. We just construct projectors onto projective irreps of these things, and then we sum over the orbit of that defect. And this is not just kind of like some random formula. You can actually use this to really easily derive certain things about the relation between the symmetry-enriched topological order and the topological order. So there's these nice formulas that appear in the Station Q paper. And actually, once you have this formula for the superselection sectors, you can derive them in like two lines. But this is, so sorry, their results apply also to chiral things. This is only for non-chiral things. But still, for that class, it's very easy to see these things. So I'll just show you how you find T. So to find T, we have this formula for this superselection sector. And the first thing that we're summing, that's going to appear in the sum is the trivial domain wall. So the action of one on the anion, which is just the defect again itself. And when we apply T to this thing, we're going to get the domain wall AG, because we've twisted around the sector of that back onto itself. But we also pick up this topological spin. And then using the fact that this factor here is a phase, we can introduce that and its conjugate. This is just a number because it's the dimension of an irrep, so we can cancel those two. And you're left with the right factor that's meant to go in the summation again, and you can pull this stuff out the front. So you see it's like two lines to find this sort of complicated looking formulas. Okay, and now let me just quickly say the inverse process, which is corresponds to actually breaking an MPO symmetry or a topological MPO symmetry. So imagine I had this symmetry algebra as like a topological symmetry. I'm not paying attention to the group grading. And imagine I break that down to the C naught sector. So I no longer have a sort of virtual level symmetry under these non-trivial group element MPOs. Then the effect of this on the tube algebra is to first split so this is going to be some ansatz for an excitation, like an anion in the purely topological theory, but I've broken the symmetry down to the one sector. So now all these, I've removed some relations from this algebra, and this thing will split into all the different elements of the conjugacy class. Then each of these elements of the conjugacy class will further split. So I can take one in sector G, that will split into all the domain walls And this one in particular will give me back a defect for that domain wall. In particular, if that domain wall is one, I can recover all the anions of the underlying theory. Okay, I probably don't have much time for examples, but it might be worth taking a few minutes of question time. So this is just the toric code written this way. We have this Z symmetry like I showed before. And all these, all this ansatz is saying here, I'm showing the non-trivial, like the non-zero elements of the tube algebra of this tensor. The one is just having no string coming in and projecting onto the plus one eigenspace of Z here. The E is projecting orthogonal to the plus one eigenspace here. The M is projecting onto the plus one eigenspace of Z here, but it has a Z string coming in. And then EM has a Z string coming in, and it's projecting orthogonal to the plus one eigenspace of Z there. The reason I showed that is because I wanted to find how you recover this from doubleizing, which I'll do in just two slides. So this, I don't want you to really understand this, but this is what happens if you work out this tube algebra for doubleizing. Now the thing you need to pay attention to is on each of these A elements, which are given by this, A, B, and C are the lines going through. So those correspond, if those are in a non-trivial sector, say the sigma, that means you have a non-trivial defect you're talking about. And then this D is the line going around, so the last index. If it's sigma, we should throw it away now because we're reducing our symmetry from the full algebra to just the C naught part of this, which is the one and psi. So if I go and throw away all these guys where sigma appears at the end, which means that the non-trivial elements surrounding this, which is no longer a symmetry, you can then calculate what happens. So some of these are immediately identified. You can just kind of, not calculate, but just read off what happens. Like this one and this one become identified. And because they have sigmas going through, they're also identified as defects. And you can see which guy condenses, which should be this one. So if you cross that one out, then you get the same thing as the vacuum. Okay. And then the other thing that can happen is a guy can split. So this guy was two irreducible idempotents summed together because of a relation in the algebra, and now we've removed that relation because we got rid of this non-trivial element. And so these now become reduced, this now becomes reducible. And so from that, you can kind of read off what happens to the anions. So these guys condense into the vacuum, this one splits into E and M, these two are identified into EM, and similarly for the defects. And then finally, you can actually go and work out the symmetry action on these defects. Oh, here I've just done the anions. So the elements spanning just the tube algebra of the toric code within this larger Ising tube algebra are these ones. And the action of the domain wall on them is written there. Okay. So if you just look at what happens to E and M, they're swapped by this. And this came from the string net construction, which was purely on sites, which means we've sort of realized this symmetry purely through like just left multiplication on the physical level. Okay, cool. Okay, so just before I finish, like a nice, several nice things have come up through this. One is that due to some results from ENO, basically this string net construction is meant to capture all sort of non-anomalous, which is a little bit I can't explain now, transversal gates in topological codes, and to really concretely realize them. And we have a way of calculating which gate you get for which input, which is nice. And then another nice thing that kind of popped out is that this condensation process really doesn't rely on you having a group grading. And if you look at these more general gradings, it seems like, well, we conjecture you can probably get back all boson condensations between doubles. Okay, I'll leave it there. Thanks for your attention.
Is that technical obstruction to playing this same game with adding your like symmetry degrees of freedom for the quantum doubles instead of for the string net?
No, I don't think there's any reason why you couldn't do it. It's just people didn't do it that way, and I prefer to think about categories. So.
Sure, yeah.
You should be able to, probably.
Models and try to reconstruct their topological order, and try to actually,
to trying to find actual new topological orders this way. I'm guessing this is probably not a very efficient way of finding new topological orders, but nevertheless, you could potentially find things that haven't been seen before. Is there any effort in that direction?
I guess that was kind of, we initially tried to approach all this like years ago from a very naive perspective. Well, we didn't really have a choice because we were very naive, but the more we learn, we're trying to do everything with a minimal amount of assumptions, but the class of tensor networks we really understand, it's always a doubled topological order for one thing. And then there's another problem with starting from, because sort of these generic tensor network states for the PEPs don't have topological order basically, it's kind of an unstable thing. And you saw that if you sort of introduced, there's some nice work by Xie Chen and collaborators that if you kind of introduce small perturbations without enforcing these topological symmetries, it can actually introduce instantaneous boson condensation basically. So you can kind of lose topological order. It's not really stable to tensor perturbations. Yeah, I think actually taking, so the ideal thing, like you said, what you'd want is start from a Hamiltonian, optimize the ground state, find its like algebra of MPOs, and then you find your topological order. Even if you don't find new topological orders, that would be super nice because we could say what phase different materials are in that we don't know. But the step of extracting the MPO from a realistic PEPS tensor doesn't seem to work so well. So far, I think all we can really do is say, I want to take an ansatz where I enforce this kind of symmetry and see how well it does. So there's a work to be done there for sure.
Any other questions? So before we close the session, are there any announcements from organizers?
I'll mention the Thursday, like, so Wednesday tomorrow we have the banquet, right? And Thursday, there's a pub night, like, informal thing in the bistro. So first floor bistro, just feel free to join, there should be a group of us there. More, I'll announce it tomorrow.
So, if there are no other questions, let's close this session and thank our speaker again.